Other Side podcast mission is to discuss important cultural and social issues relating to race, culture, gender, and equality.
Welcome. Thanks for joining us for another episode of the Other Side podcast. I'm your host, Scott Kirk, and today we have former Columbus Mayor Michael B. Coleman joining us. Mayor Coleman was the first African-American to serve as mayor of Ohio's capital city, Columbus. Mr. Coleman also served four terms as mayor, making him the longest serving mayor in Columbus's history, as well as the country's longest serving Black mayor. He is currently the partner in charge of government law at the law firm Ice Miller. Thank you for joining me. I really appreciate it.
Thanks for inviting me and look forward to the discussion.
During your time as mayor, did you ever experience anything like what the city has been experiencing in the last 6 months? And that includes the social justice protests as well as COVID-19.
Well, let me just say this. The answer is, what we're seeing in America now and cities now in every city across the country is unprecedented. Even during my time when I thought I had some tough situations, this is frankly unprecedented. And let me just start out by saying that the job of a mayor is the toughest job in America. I will tell you that it's only become tougher, more difficult since my day. Well, the reason is several. One, there's a pandemic, COVID, that has affected every human being on this globe, particularly those in the Black community. Number two is the division that exists, especially out of Washington, which is unprecedented. I thought there was division back in my day. The division I'm seeing now coming from this president is unlike anything I've seen since the Civil War. The economy is the worst I've seen ever in my lifetime, and I lived through some tough times. I was the mayor of the city during the financial crisis and when the city almost went broke during that time in 2008, but the economy is really tough on so many people, particularly as it relates to Black folks. And the civil unrest has unleashed a torrent of history bottled up in Black folks, as well as white folks, who saw for the first time on camera something that they've never seen before. You know, you see it in the streets of our city, good ways and bad ways. Time now is very different. So I want to point out a couple things, though, that kind of underline some of these issues. Like when I talk about Washington versus the mayor's role now in Columbus and other cities, the president of our nation gets up every day with this thought in mind. How do I divide the nation further to stoke my support? That's what the president does now. The mayor and mayors across the country get up in the morning every day with the charge of how do I solve problems in the community? While the president has absolved himself of responsibility to a large extent, the burden shifts even more so than even my time to mayors across the country. I think Mayor Genther is doing a great job. He's in a tough situation. He's getting a hit from the left and the right all at the same time. And when I talk to him, I say, follow your conscience, follow your North Star. And he's been doing that. So while the past several months have been really tough for the country, tough for the city, tough to manage for mayors and leaders and governors, very difficult, tougher than my day, even, that I think that going forward, it's going to get tougher, as tough, if not tougher, than where we are today. And the reason is because everybody's gone into their corners. There's no middle ground. There's the radical left, and there's also the radical right. And I think what needs to happen in America is a radical middle. And I think that's where most people are anyway, in the middle. And the middle isn't so much about being in the middle on issues. It really means the idea of a radical middle means, you know, means that you're working together in spite of differences under an umbrella of reform and progress. That's where the radical middle is. And that's the greatest challenge of the city and the country going forward. Reforms need to continue. It means forging progress by radically insisting on respect, civility, and with the idea of getting to solutions. That's the radical middle.
How would you have handled the protests? I'm sure most people know this, but after the George Floyd was killed on tape by police officers, that sparked protests, not just nationwide, but worldwide, including here in Columbus. And so if you had been mayor still, how would you have handled that? How would you have balanced allowing people to express their frustration and their grief and anger and all those things versus trying to keep the city safe?
Well, people have a right to protest, to peacefully protest. People do not have the right to commit violence on anyone. And there's always a balance there that you have to recognize. When peacefully protesting is something that we should embrace always. That's what our nation was founded on. That's what we've done over the years. That's what we did in the 60s and in the 70s. That caused the greatest change in America. Violence is not something that can be tolerated. So at any level, whether in the neighborhoods or in the downtown streets of Columbus. So those things always have to be balanced. And it's tough to do so. And frankly, you know, I don't think, while the city of Columbus has had experience, I had experience in my day of protests. The Klan, I think, came two or three times to Columbus and protested on the steps of City Hall over my objection, but they had the right to protest. It was very uncomfortable to hear what they were saying in their epitaphs. Right outside my office on City Hall, things they said about me and others, but they had the right to say what they said. At the same time, should that have turned into a violent situation, we were prepared to deal with it at that time.
I want to dig just a little bit deeper on this point. I want to read just a couple of quotes from you that you posted on your Facebook page not too long ago. And one of them is, quote, "Mere words are not enough. It is our actions that matter. Protest is patriotic. We must listen to those who are assembling to express their justifiable rage and anguish, even and especially when it makes us uncomfortable." So with that being said, how would you respond to people who say that peaceful protests don't invoke change, that it's only when property is destroyed or protests become violent that it really grabs the public's attention? Why should people who already feel disenfranchised and ignored be concerned about what they see, what they perceive as wealthy corporations, businessmen, and government agencies that are also complicit in the inequity? So in other words, why should people who feel ignored and disenfranchised be concerned about the destruction of a government building or the destruction of a department store chain or something like that? How would you respond to those people?
Well, I stand by my statement because I think my statement is right. And I think everyone has the right to peacefully protest, to express their anger, to address their concerns. But I just adamantly disagree that the circumstances of today require a violent act. That violent act, whether it be on a downtown building, can be taken in a neighborhood. And soon as that starts happening in a neighborhood, you know, do we stand by and let it happen? No, we don't. We can't allow violence to take place. That's not how America works. That's not what we should tolerate. We should embrace people expressing their view, marching, protesting, being loud about it. But it does matter. And history has shown that when one protests peacefully in an organized way, that protest turns to progress almost every time. But if it's only a few people protesting, if it's just a small amount of people protesting, fewer people hear the protests. The bigger the protests, the louder the protests, the greater the voices are, if we come together in a way. But violence is not, I don't agree with it in any way. I'm just sorry. And I understand people's frustrations. Frustrations are clear. I get it. I'm frustrated. You know, as first Black mayor of the city, I went through stuff nobody knows about.
You want to share?
Oh, I'd love to share. I intend on sharing one day.
Today?
They give me the headlines. I got up every day, every single day, knowing that I was the first in the city and that I was treated differently at multiple levels. But I had to put that aside and go do my job and try to be change the city in every way I could. Now, was I frustrated? There are many times I was frustrated. Now, having said that, I think people need to express their frustrations. And maybe I should have expressed it more. I don't know. But one thing I do know is that violence was not the way to go. It is not the way to go today. And I think if people come together and fight for change, when you fight for change, that doesn't mean you kill the person across sitting from you. You don't pull the gun out. You don't knock them upside the head. That isn't change. That's a criminal act. You don't burn down a building. That isn't change. That's a criminal act. But standing in front of that building saying, we demand change. We organize for change. We vote to get people out of office that don't adhere to change. That's what we should be doing. And it bothers me when I hear people say that my vote doesn't matter. It absolutely does matter. 100% matter. If we had a few more people to vote in 2016, some of this we wouldn't be having today because of who's in charge in Washington, D.C. So I think voting is the supreme example of what we have to do to execute change in America. And if it turns to something else, so I don't adhere to the notion that crime and violence is the right answer. It is not. It's the wrong answer, whether you're on the left or whether you're on the right.
So as a mayor, as a former mayor, you had to rely on the police department to keep residents safe, order in the city, and all those things. And in some cases, as a politician, you also need the support of organizations like the FOP to either be elected or win re-election. But you also have a responsibility to your residents in addressing their concerns. Did you ever find it hard to strike a balance between having a good relationship with the police department and at the same time looking out for everyday citizens?
No, I didn't conflate the two. So my number one priority was to keep residents safe. That was very important to me. So my focus was safety in the neighborhoods and to those residents as well. I did have many encounters with the FOP, more than any other mayor in the history of the city. Some were good, some were bad. There was always a tension. When I first took the office of mayor, the Department of Justice, the couple years or a year before I took office, had come and started an investigation and lawsuit against the city of Columbus for racial profiling, for stops. And so during that time, I worked out a negotiation with the Department of Justice, and I negotiated with them for certain reforms in the city. And at that time, there were significant reforms. There were racial profiling issues, stops, Internal Affairs Bureau, and several other issues that I dealt with. Video dash cams. At that time, video dash cams were unheard of, right? Now it's a standard practice.
Now it's body cams.
Right. Well, body cams, you know, that started at the end of my administration, and Ginther took it forward. and to his credit, you know, how the Internal Affairs Bureau handled complaints back in those days. I mean, those were major reforms back in those days, data collection back in those days. And so I negotiated something with the Department of Justice that at that time resulted in significant reforms in the Division of Police. But my relationship with the FOP was up and down during my time as mayor. So the way I look at things is I look at the police officers differently from the institution of policing, which I also have a third bucket, the FOP. Police officers, policing, the history of policing in America and in Columbus, and the FOP. There's three buckets, and I was able to distinguish between all three. The fourth bucket was the biggest bucket of all, safety of our neighborhoods. That was the most important thing. I do not view police officers individually as racist. I think that police officers in Columbus have the toughest job. They deserve our respect. I care for them. It's one of the highest callings of public service. But I do view the institution of policing as being part of systemic racism and institutional racism in America, including Columbus. Over the years, sometimes I had great tensions with the FOP. And again, these are three different buckets. I honor the police officer, respect them. They do a good job. We need them. They need us to make our community safe. At the same time, that policing and Division of Police has a long history nationally as well as locally that clearly has an institutional racism and systemic racism in society.
How did you root that out?
I'm saying individual police officers in Columbus are not racist. The institution of policing in Columbus as well as around the country is a part of systemic and institutional racism.
You fix that, though, if the organization is made up of individuals, how do you fix that systemic problem?
Well, you go at the system. You try to work at the system. So a lot of it is in the contract that the FOP has. So I support 100% the mayor's initiative for a civilian review board, and I think it helps.
How do you think it'll help?
I think what it does is add another layer of civilian accountability on police conduct, and that helps. I think, so I proposed, while I was mayor, a civilian review board. It went nowhere at the time. It didn't even have subpoena power, but I was trying to achieve some level of additional civilian accountability. And I think if this is done right, and I believe it will be, that the civilian review board will enhance civilian accountability. It's okay. We shouldn't fear it. Police shouldn't fear it. Just like they should not have feared video cams and body cameras. There was resistance back in my day for those as well. They ultimately agreed to it because they didn't have a choice and they focused more on the issue of disciplining. So I think it helps. In addition, I think there's things that can be addressed at the contractual level that now there's leverage to deal with. One is the civilian review board. The other is the concept of past practice. And the third is seniority. So,
can you just explain a little what past practice, what that means?
Yeah, essentially what it means is there's a doctrine of past practice that when a police officer gets disciplined for whatever reason, that there's the right to appeal that by the FOP. And in the event that discipline somehow is not consistent with past practice, that officer usually ends up back on the force, back in uniform, and the discipline goes for naught. And the problem with past practice is that sometimes past practice is bad practice. And the impact of the notion that you can't do anything unless past practice justifies present practice is a problem. And so that needs to be addressed. In addition, I think the issue of seniority is an issue that needs to be addressed in the FOP contract. So the way it works is that seniority is very important, probably the most important part of police officers gaining experience in different jobs and assignments within a department. It is my view that sometimes seniority has a disparate impact on Black folks in particular and women when it comes to seniority, because there's fewer Black folks that have seniority and fewer women that have seniority within a department and therefore don't get the prime assignments, because the assignments are based on seniority, not based upon merit sometimes, many times. And that has a disparate impact on race within a department. So therefore, when it comes time to see growth of those who are African-American and females in a department to climb up the ladder of leadership and gaining the experience to get that, because they don't have seniority, it's hard for them to climb that ladder. Seniority plays too much of a role, I guess, in the experience of police officers climbing up that ladder. And back to history, police departments around the country were established to round up Black folks, to perpetuate slavery in the very early days. And in the history of Columbus, it took a federal court to mandate integration in the Columbus Police Department. It took the Department of Justice to force reforms in the police department. And now the death of George Floyd will get to the next level. Every generation requires ongoing improvement in the division of police. But police officers as individuals, I respect, I honor. They got a tough job, and they largely do what they're told to do and what they're trained to do. That is important in this discussion. And racism, institutional racism, exists. It exists in Columbus. It exists with Division of Police, the Columbus Dispatch, and the city of Columbus, in all corners of our community. And we have to fight it in every way we can as a community. It does not necessarily say that the individuals within these institutions are racist themselves.
Of course, the Black community is not monolithic, but in general, there's a lack of trust, I think, between Black brown communities and police departments.
That is true.
Some of the very reasons that you just named.
Yes, that is true.
How do we fix that?
You know, that's the key question going forward. How do we fix it? In my view, it is, I'm optimistic. I'm an optimistic person. My leadership style has always been optimistic. But I think there's a lot of history here on both sides. And Black folks, justifiably, over time, have had to deal with generation after generation of police issues that impacts them in a negative way. At the same time, they want to be held safe as well. They depend on the police, while at the same time, they're nervous about it. And you have to understand that history matters here. We all have to understand it. And so it's like saying, well, slavery doesn't exist today, so there's no reason to recognize slavery. Well, yeah, we have a lot of reasons to recognize slavery. History is such that slavery has put Black folks and people of color in a disadvantage generations later. You know, my great-great-grandmother was a slave. She was sold from one slave owner in Virginia to a slave owner in Kentucky. She was born in the 1830s and died in the 1940s. She lived to be 104 years old. She never knew how to read. She never knew how to write. She never voted. And her great-great-grandson ended up to be the mayor of the city of Columbus. I put her picture, we had a picture of her, one of a couple pictures ever of her, in my office as mayor. And so when people came to see me for whatever, they'd have to walk by her first. That was history. And sometimes they'd walk back out and I said, that's my great-great-grandmother. She's born a slave. That's symbolic. And it meant a lot to me as a mayor to have my great-great-grandmother right there greeting everybody that came in to see the mayor's every single person. And that was, for me, motivating every day. And I walk in the office every day and I look at her because I walk by her too. So I'm going to hold it up. This is for you, great-great-grandma. Her name was Dean, Margaret Dean. So I got off point. But
no, you're fine.
But that's an important part of who I am. So the point is, history is important in where we are today. And that it's hard not to look at the past and say it never happened. And we just got to move forward. Well, we can't do that. We have to acknowledge the past. We have to acknowledge that racism exists. We have to acknowledge that there is a dynamic between police and the community. We need to acknowledge that and not be afraid to acknowledge it, to embrace it, because that's who we are and that's what happened. We can't ignore history. So what we have to do is we say, all right, let's acknowledge it. But let's come out the corner. Let's lay down our arms. Let's go in with the idea that we need the police to stay safe and they need us to be effective. And policing needs to take on a new course. But we have to start with some simple, basic concepts. And the first basic concept is we must work together. That's what we have to do. And we must be radical about working together. That's the radical middle. We must be radical about the idea that in order for us to improve as a country, to improve as a city, to improve as a police department, to improve as neighborhoods, we must come together. And after the storm passes, we must seek to rebuild in every way we can. And it starts with the acknowledgement and begins with, all right, how do we move forward together? Let's come out the corner. And that's the challenge of leadership in the future, the challenge that all mayors, all city councils are going to have going forward, all police departments, all neighborhoods, is that we have to find a way to bridge and not just discuss, but make those reforms necessary so that we can exist together in a way where we're safe and secure, while at the same time, there isn't the fear that exists now between the police and the community. We got to go with that mentality. I don't have all the answers, but it starts with attitude.
And for everybody else out there, thanks again for tuning in. Don't forget, we really love to hear from our listeners. So check out our Facebook page or our Twitter page and hit us up. Let us know what you think of the show or just how you're doing with everything that's going on. We really love to hear from you. And don't forget that this is part one of a two-part episode interview with former Columbus Mayor Coleman. So don't forget to check back for part two. And until then, don't forget to try to see things from the other side. Thanks.